In the matter of State versus Wilbert Hanna, may we please have appearances of counsel?
Andrew Burrows on behalf of Appellant Cross Respondent Wilbert Hanna.
Morning, Your Honors. Edney Martinez, Assistant Prosecutor for the Respondent, Hudson County Prosecutor's Office.
Morning, Your Honors. Deputy Attorney General Daniel A. Finkelstein, appearing as a friend of the court on behalf of the Attorney General of New Jersey.
Good morning, counsel, and welcome. Mr. Burrows, please go ahead.
Thank you. With the court's permission, appellant asked for 2 minutes of rebuttal time.
That's fine.
May it please the court. In 1993, a drug deal turned into a violent robbery. Defendant admitted that while he had helped to set up a drug buy, he had no foreknowledge that co-defendant William LeCue and Maurice Thomas had planned to rob the two victims. The defense was third-party guilt. Mary Jones, Thomas's mother, testified that her son said he planned to set up defendant to take the fall, thus allowing Thomas to escape justice. Thomas's statements were inculpatory, as they were declarations against his penal interest, and they were exculpatory as they corroborated defendant's third-party guilt defense and had a direct bearing on his guilt. Thomas had outlined a scheme with his girlfriend Arlene Forrester and LeCue to frame defendant. He saw in LeCue the perfect tool by which to set up defendant. LeCue went to school, had no criminal record, and the state would go easier on him. Thomas gave $5,000 to Arlene to give to LeCue. Thomas took possession of the victim's stolen money and drugs from LeCue, who called Thomas his, quote, chief. Thomas described his modus operandi of setting up drug deals to stage phony robberies without defendant's knowledge. Jones's testimony is reliable, and it is corroborated by other evidence in the record. Jones's testimony was barred because defendant had failed to establish a relevancy nexus between Thomas and the victims to support a third-party guilt defense, and his declarations were inadmissible hearsay. Thus, this crucial testimony was withheld from the jury, and without Thomas's exculpatory testimony, defendant's third-party guilt defense was fatally undermined. The assistant prosecutor had assured the trial court that there was not a scintilla of evidence of Thomas's involvement with the victims of the crime or the crime. A significant issue at trial was a pager number written on a piece of paper found in the victim's shirt pocket. The state asserted that as this pager number was registered in defendant's name, it proved that defendant had been in contact with the victims the night of the incident. The prosecutor used this fact to undermine defendant's claim that he had been set up by Thomas. In 2007, defendant discovered a police report which had never been provided to the defense, the so-called Red Report. That report contained information not found elsewhere. Lieutenant Red had found two numbers written on a piece of paper in the victim's pocket. The first was a pager number registered in defendant's name. The second was Arlene's home telephone number. When Red dialed the pager number, Thomas, not defendant, responded. Defendant submits, had this evidence been available at trial, it would have satisfied the trial court's relevancy nexus that Thomas had been involved with the victims to admit Jones's testimony. The information contained in the Red Report and Jones's testimony is inseparably linked. And when considered in light of all the surrounding circumstances and in the context of Thomas's whole statement, Thomas's declarations are admissible as statements against interest. When the evidence is analyzed in the context of the state's case, which relied heavily on the testimony of Arlene's sister, Hazel, and LeCue, and where no forensic evidence linked defendant to the crime, the outcome of the trial would have been very different had the information in the Red Report and Jones's testimony been presented to the jury. Hazel testified she overheard defendant confess to a murder at 11:30 p.m. at Arlene's apartment. However, at the first PCR hearing, Maria Cosme testified that she was coming home that night when she saw an African-American male with braids standing on a street corner talking to a girl, just as defendant had testified, corroborating his alibi. A few minutes later, just after midnight, she heard shots fired and saw the man standing on the corner run. Cosme's testimony challenges Hazel's credibility, and certainly the jury already doubted Hazel's reliability when it acquitted defendant of murder. The only evidence presented to prove robbery in this case was LeCue's testimony. LeCue had already been undermined when he said that defendant had shot the victim in the right side of his head as he sat in the driver's passenger seat. The autopsy showed that the victim had been shot on the left side of his head while sitting in the driver's seat, and that the shooter was likely standing outside the car, shooting the victim at a downward trajectory. The question remains, who then was the shooter standing outside the victim's car when the fatal shot was fired? Further, Would the jury have believed LeCue about the robbery if it had learned of his involvement with Thomas? The appellate panel found the evidence was material and it was not discoverable by reasonable diligence beforehand. Further, as this case was a close one, this additional evidence possessed the clear capacity to have altered the outcome. Fairness requires that defendant should have the benefit of these new facts, which would have a direct consequence on the issue of his guilt. Thank you, and that concludes my opening remarks. If I can answer any questions or clarify any points for the court before I continue with argument.
Mr. Burroughs, I'd like you to try to help us with the framework for analysis, and I think you touched on some of it in just your yes. opening remarks. Put aside the second prong of ways.
Yes.
For you to prevail, is it correct that you would have to demonstrate three things? Number one, that the Thomas statement through Jones or some portion of it is a statement against interest and thus admissible. Two, that the statement would bolster the defense of third party guilt in order for you to be able to demonstrate a likelihood that the outcome would be different in this case. And three, that the information in the Red Report, the newly discovered evidence in this case, revives or enhances the argument that was presented on direct appeal about 803C25. Otherwise, it would be a straight redo. Am I correct that you would have to demonstrate each of those three strands?
I would have to demonstrate those. I would agree with that. I'd also have to demonstrate that the Red Report provides a relevancy nexus that the trial judge required. Yes.
May I follow up then?
Yes.
Can you parse for us the particular parts of the Thomas statement that satisfies all three of those pieces?
Yes, I can. First of all, I would like to use the test that this court has outlined in White in my analysis. And there, this court said that appropriate test for admissibility is either in the context of the whole statement, the particular remark was plausibly against defendant's penal interest, even though it might be neutral, even self-serving if considered alone. So here we have a series of comments or conversations by Thomas with his mother about how he's going to set up the defendant. He uses word set up, take the weight, so that the defendant can take the weight for the killing and the robbery that, of course, I suggested that likely it was Thomas who had committed that event. We find that Thomas admits that he's taking possession of the drugs and the money from the victims, clearly inculpatory. How do we know that? We know that because he tells his mother, this is the drugs that the police are looking for. He's taking possession of it from LeCue. And more importantly, he says it's labeled, gotta have it. And in his statement to the police, to Lieutenant Red, he says the victim sold their drugs under the label, gotta have it. So we can put that together. We can say these drugs, these are the proceeds from the robbery. So now we have Thomas directly implicated in the robbery. So that's inculpatory right there. He's neither at minimum an accomplice after the fact, but then he talks about setting up the defendant. And I find this case is very similar on point to the case State v. Sedulis and State v. West. So I would refer to answer Chief Justice's question to Sedulis. Now, what happened in Sedulis in 1967, which this court has favorably recognized and cited in White? Sedulis, let's read him for Wilbert Hanna, goes to a car and he's arrested by the police for possession of drugs and charged with distribution of CDS. Sedulis, the police got the information from an informant by the name of Camacho, read Maurice Thomas. Sedulis wanted to present the testimony of a Miss Maldonado, read Mary Jones, who is prepared to testify that Camacho had said he was planned to frame the defendant for possession of the drugs. Now the appellate panel in that case said that was admissible. Why did they say it was admissible? Because it went to the issue of whether Sedulis was guilty or not. It went to his third party guilt defense.
So may I interrupt you for a second? Because that's an appellate ruling. This is a second PCR where we've already had a direct appeal on the admissibility of the Jones statement. And the powerful language that you've alluded to, set up, and I think take the weight would fall in that same category, was in front of the court on direct appeal. So tease out the third piece that I asked that you needed to demonstrate. How does the red statement revive the issue as relates to set up and carry the weight and so on?
How it's a linkage. It really is linkage here. The red report is the key that opens up Mary Jones's testimony. It's because the trial court had said, well, I can't let this in because you haven't demonstrated that this Thomas guy is involved in this incident with the victims of the crime. So I'm suppressing Mary Jones's testimony substantively. The red report was not known to the defense. And the red report links Thomas directly to the victims. Because when Lieutenant Red dials that pager number within an hour or two of the victim's murder, it's not defendant who answers, it's Thomas who responds. And let's not forget, Chief Justice, after trial, that this pager number was a major issue at trial. The assistant prosecutor on cross-examination of Mr. Hanna, as well as in her summation, she said, because this pager is registered to the defendant, this shows that he's in contact with the victim. This shows that he was set up. She used words at trial that there was not a scintilla of evidence linking Thomas to the victims. It was a sham. It was a con job by the defense. So I would submit, not only does the red report is the key to Mary Jones, had the red report been known, the prosecutor could not have made those kinds of statements on cross-examination or
in Ms. Burroughs. I understand the procedural context here. You're linking the red report to the statements that are attributed to Thomas, but am I not mistaken? The Thomas statements were always a declaration against interest. It wasn't raised the first time, but it was there. You've given some of the statements that Thomas made to his mother. He also had told his mother that he had met with the very drug dealers who wound up being killed in this case. Not only did they have his beeper number, that he had, tell me if I'm mistaken, that he was supposed to bring drugs to them. And he linked himself to those drug dealers. Am I correct about that?
I believe he does link themselves to the drug dealers.
In addition to saying he was setting him up and he was going to be sticking the defendant here to taking the weight, correct? And then he calls up the police anonymously, basically implicating the defendant in this case.
Correct.
And he has one of the people living with him calling up the police anonymously implicating him.
Correct.
I mean,
there but was- as I understand, the trial court did not allow Jones's testimony because it felt that she would be a sideshow. So the jury never heard any of those statements that you recounted, that Jones wanted to repeat to the jury as having been said by her son. The court said they weren't relevant. So as I understood your PCR argument, the red report, by linking that pager number to Thomas and having him answer it, answered the relevancy question that you say was not determined appropriately at the time of trial. Is that right?
No, I don't say that the trial judge made an incorrect decision. The trial judge didn't have all the information to make.
Well, in looking at it in hindsight now with this newly discovered evidence, the relevancy piece you say is answered.
Correct. And under case law related to third party guilt, as your justice knows, the linkage doesn't have to be significant. It just has, the defendant has to show a linkage of right. some relevancy.
The defendant was precluded from putting on all of the evidence he wanted to in connection with this third party guilt defense.
Correct. I mean, it's very similar to the case in Sedulis. I realize that was an appellate division, Justice. One thing that I would like to go back to this whole red report, of course, it came from a Brady motion. The defendant filed a Brady motion. The appellate division said, well, we didn't find the Brady violation. But I believe the appellate panel in that case was troubled by this case. And this is why they remanded on the newly discovered evidence. This is the appellate division's decision that something is wrong in this case. And I would ask the court to not only look at Mary Jones's statements, but to look at the overhear recorded conversations on DA 56 to DA 60 that I've cited in my brief. where we have the conversations between Thomas and between LaQue, which were never presented to the jury, by the way. Those conversations were never used at trial. And it's clear when you read those conversations, it corroborates much of what Jones is talking about and saying that her son is telling her. As well, it clearly indicates who likely was the individual standing outside the victim's.
Mr. Burroughs, I know that you've just raised Brady, but under 313.3, which is our discovery rules, all police reports have to be turned over. We don't have to go to Brady.
Yes,
if that red report was not turned over, it was a direct violation of our discovery rules. Am I correct about that?
You are. I didn't raise a Brady because the appellate division already found no Brady violation. I'm not quite sure why they would not have found a Brady violation, but I'm not relitigating that issue before this court. I'm using Carter Ways, which is what the appellate division specifically remanded back to the PCR court, do an evidentiary hearing on Carter Ways. Was this red report newly discovered evidence?
What did the jury hear about Thomas and his role in connection with any of the criminality?
The only thing that the jury really heard was my client's testimony. He testified at trial and he testified about his relationship with Thomas. He admitted he had been in drug deals with Thomas before, and he said that he had been set up by Thomas. The prosecutor basically said this was a sham job by the defense, that there was no evidence at all linking Thomas to these victims, no evidence linking Thomas to the crime. So essentially the jury heard incomplete factual information. My client, essentially because of the lack of the red report, he couldn't show the relevancy nexus to get Mary Jones's testimony in. He didn't have a complete defense.
So to be crystal clear, nothing in the state's case, I'm not talking about the argument that was advanced, no evidence in the state's case about Thomas and connection and a connection to criminality, is that correct?
I saw nothing in the state's case in my reading of the trial transcripts that they had linked Thomas at all. In fact, if I hate to say this, well, I don't hate to say it, but I'll say it. There seems to have been a great effort here to sanitize Thomas out of this trial. When you look at the lack of the red report, Lieutenant Red was the lead detective. He didn't testify. Well, what's the first question that a good defense counsel will ever ask? Did you write a report? If you look at the statement that Red takes from Thomas, he says, we paged you. He says that. And Thomas says, yes. But he doesn't say we paged you from the number we found on a bloody piece of paper in the victim's pocket, which in an investigation, one would think any detective would ask. Why do you have the pager of written in a bloody piece of pocket in the victim's?
You're also saying that the state misinformed the jury. Now, I don't know whether or not the prosecutor had the red report, but the red report had in the victim's pocket the number to Thomas's pager.
Correct.
And then the prosecutor in summation says there isn't a scintilla of evidence linking Thomas to this murder. Correct. Which directly contradicted what was in the red report.
That's correct. But not only that, Justice, the assistant prosecutor not just said that, but she said because the pager is registered in defendant's name, she said that's evidence he was in contact with the victims that night. And she used that to discredit him on cross-examination, knowing that she would have had the red report in her possession and knowing about the suppressed testimony of Mary Jones. It's a troubling case in many, many ways.
We also know now that after the police called Thomas from the number that was in the victim's pocket, Thomas then called the police before he went down to anonymously implicate the defendant in the case.
Correct. And when you look in this case, and very carefully in the case, and I've had this case since 2017, so I know it well, all behind this investigation, there's one hand that's moving the police in a certain direction. Who makes the anonymous call first directing the police to Wilbert Hanna? It's Thomas. Who places the second anonymous call saying, go to this apartment. There's someone there who knows that Wilbert Hanna confessed the murder. Arlene Forrester, his girlfriend. And then who tells him to flee and get out of town? And Wilbert Hanna then goes to Florida. It's Thomas. And then an anonymous phone call is placed to the police saying that Hanna is down in Jacksonville. I don't know if Thomas placed that information, I don't have. But all throughout this case, there is the hand of Maurice Thomas pushing this investigation in a certain direction, always towards Wilbert Hanna. And the jury didn't hear that. And
can you correct one thing for me?
Yes.
I thought that Hanna had testified that he and Thomas sold drugs in the same area.
Yes.
And obtained their drugs from the same source.
Yes.
Doesn't that already link Thomas to the victims?
Well, that's the jury obviously would to see that Mr. Hanna's testimony.
No, I'm asking you. I mean, there was nothing to connect Thomas to this case. I mean, there was nothing to it to connect. Yeah, nothing was offered. Nothing was before the jury on this issue.
No.
It sounds like the defendant kind of pounded that home and out of his own mouth said that Thomas and he dealt drugs in the same area and obtained them from the same sources. And these two New York guys were his source, a source.
Hanna did testify to that. That's what he said. That was the relationship. We had done drugs together. We had done drugs with these sources out of New York City. Yes, the defendant testified to that, but it was, he could not link, except for his own testimony that Thomas was there at the time. He had no independent evidence to show that Thomas was involved with those two victims, that he was involved with those two victims that night. That's where the Red Report is so significant, because then Jones's testimony would have come in, you see.
But by his testimony in that regard, and he's never disputed that they were getting drugs from his source, from the sources from New York.
Yes.
Their sources from New York.
Yes.
That he was at the scene.
Yes.
And frankly, was there when the shots were fired. Just he was, according to his story, was off talking to a young lady.
Correct. He was at the corner of Sackett and Clinton talking to a young lady when the shots were fired. But we now know that's corroborated by the testimony of Maria Cosme from the first PCR.
But the jury acquitted him of murder by his own hand.
Right.
So the jury didn't decide that he put the bullet in one of the victims' heads. The
Correct.
Jury decided exactly what you're suggesting may have in fact happened, that he was at the scene where a drug deal was going down. He was involved in the robbery, but not involved in the murder. In other words, the evidence that you're suggesting changes everything doesn't apparently change anything about the jury's verdict.
Well, I'm not sure if the jury had known about the Red Report and Mary Jones's testimony. The only evidence that of my client committing the robbery, again, is LeCue's testimony. There's no other evidence in this trial.
Oh, I get that, but also his testimony that he's there.
He's there down the street at a corner, yes. And he had set up the drug deal. He admitted to all of that.
Okay.
Mr. Burroughs, I know you said this earlier, and this is actually in response to the question that Justice Sullivan's raised. What do we know from the fact that the jury acquitted him of murder? We don't, like, how can we know why they did that? They may have compromised. There may have been 11 jurors to convict him of first degree, regular murder. And the rest of them may have said, look, we've got him on felony murder, like why bother? I'm speculating now. We can speculate 1,000 scenarios, okay? Compromise, whatever. So I don't know why you're trying to draw some principle, or why anyone should be drawing a principle out of the fact that the jury decided to find him not guilty of the murder piece. Why don't you respond to that?
Well, of course, we can never know what the jury was thinking when it was thinking and when it was deliberating.
Isn't that exactly what you're doing, counsel, speculating as to what the jury might have done with this evidence?
What I'm doing is
that exactly what you're doing, speculating? Because the third prong of ways requires that kind of, and so you're speculating right now that had the jury had the report, they would have found him not guilty. So you're speculating also, aren't you?
Of course, I would admit that I'm speculating, but I'm speculating based on looking at the weight of the state's case on the robbery charge against Wilbert Hanna.
Go ahead, could finish. I'm sorry.
I'm speculating, though, based on as the test of the third prong of way, we look at the strength, and Nash says we look at the strength of the state's case. Remember, I'm looking only at the robbery charge here, and the robbery charge The only evidence of the robbery charge is LaCue's testimony. But once the jury had learned he was involved with Thomas to the degree that we now know that he likely was involved with Thomas, would the jury have accepted that testimony? Clearly they didn't accept his testimony about
and the one thing we do know is that LaCue's testimony is definitely false because he claimed that Hannah shot the victim while Hannah was sitting in the passenger seat of the car,
right,
and the victim was shot from on the other side of his face. So LaCue was obviously lying, at least about that, yes?
He was. Medically, that was an impossibility, correct.
And one thing we do know that the jury concluded, we don't have to, and we don't go behind the verdict. We look at the verdict. The jury concluded, consistent with what Justice Albin just said, that Hannah did not kill the victim, either victim, by his own hand.
That's correct.
No, they concluded that.
We do.
They concluded, therefore, that LaCue's testimony that he did was false.
Correct.
We know that much.
We do. And we know also that the only evidence of the robbery was LaCue. So we have to assume that the jury accepted LaCue's credibility, at least on that one point, because that's what Mr. Hannah was convicted of, the robbery, which led to the felony murder. So since there's no other evidence of the robbery, and LaCue says he was involved in the robbery, he planned the robbery, that's what convicted Hannah. What would the, and the question has to be asked, what would the jury have concluded had it seen, known all of the evidence that was suppressed? And that's really the question.
I don't, how are we supposed to conclude that, I don't know what the jury decided, that he, the jury decided that he didn't kill him by his own hand. He could have shot him from the other side of the car.
He wasn't convicted. He was convicted of felony murder. Not murder.
So what? I mean, we don't know.
All right, I won't argue with you, Justice Abbott. Yeah, I'm talking. I'm not making a case for the prosecution.
I know.
But I'm not making a case for the defendant. Others may, but I'm not. I'm just asking the question. Look,
you can be convicted of felony murder by shooting someone directly.
That's not a debate I need to have with
Mr. Burroughs. I'm not correct about that.
It's possible. It's possible the jury could have thought many things about this.
There are many cases where three people, they wind up shooting someone.
Yes.
Okay, including the shooter, all convicted of felony murders. Is that an atypical scenario in our system of justice? I don't think so.
No, that can happen. It's worth remembering though, that LaCue had given three, in his statement, he gave two statements to the police and then he testified at trial. He gave three different versions of this event, by the way. First, he said that the defendant and he had shot the victims. Then in a second statement of the police, he says, no, I did it. I want the death penalty. Then on his third, which is his testimony, he then reverts back to the first one and he says that it was defendant who shot him in the front passenger seat. So perhaps the jury also had some issues with his credibility on the whole murder part of it. But again, I think that the Nash test is the right test here, and that's to look at the strength of the state's case against the new evidence. And the if there were forensic evidence linking Mr. Hannah to the robbery, if there was other witnesses that linked him to this robbery, but there are none. It's only—
And counsel, in looking at that third prong the way you're describing it now, how do we factor in the fact that the defendant was trying to present this full story through the testimony of Ms. Jones and was prevented from fully presenting his defense? How do we connect those two pieces? It's not just the new evidence and what it means, but it's also the effect that it had, the not being able to present it at the original trial, is it not?
Correct, it is. It was only his unsupported, uncorroborated, self-serving testimony that Thomas was setting me up for this and I didn't do it. That's all that Mr. Hannah could say. And what's very frustrating to me is how the prosecutor then used the fact that that pager was registered in his name to discredit him, knowing that there's this red report sitting out there, knowing that this suppressed Mary Jones testimony was there of what she had said about what her son had said. Yet here, the only evidence that Hannah could present on his behalf is, I was set up by Thomas.
So it's not just the lack of the information, it's also the result of the lack of the information and its effect on the jury's perception of defendant's credibility.
I think that goes to it, corroborating his testimony.
Let me just ask you one question, counsel.
Please.
How do you know the prosecutor knew that there was in the red report and chose to hide it? Are you arguing now prosecutorial misconduct?
No, I'm not. I'm not arguing that.
Then how do you know the prosecutor had it and did not share it?
I believe at the PCR hearing, the third PCR hearing, I think the assistant prosecutor did testify, and I think she said she didn't really recall the case that well, if I recall correctly. So yes, I am assuming that the prosecutor had that possession, but that brings up even more troubling questions. If the prosecutor didn't have it, why didn't she have it?
Aren't they charged with having it, and knowledge of it anyway?
I'm sorry, say that again.
Aren't they charged with having knowledge of it anyway?
They are. Under the law, Lieutenant Red was her agent, and so all that he knows, it is assumed that the prosecutor would know. I also find it very interesting that Lieutenant Red was never called. He's the lead detective in this, you know. He's the one who investigated the case. He's the one that put the links together. He was never called as a witness in this case. All the other detectives were, but not his. And what I found, and I put this in my brief, troubling. If you look at all the other police reports, do you notice how they cross-reference each other? There's one report that's never cross-referenced, and that's the Red report. And the 705 pager number, that's the pager number we're talking about here, is never mentioned in any other police report at all. Only in the Red report is it mentioned. Can I say that someone scrubbed this trial to keep Maurice Thomas? What was Maurice Thomas's relationship with Lieutenant Red? What was his relationship with law enforcement? I do not know, and I cannot say. All I can say is the jury didn't hear all the facts.
Mr. Burroughs, I want to ask you a question that, and I'll tell you upfront, maybe unrelated to the facts or to the case here, but I'd like your help, and it relates to the statement against interest hearsay rule that we have.
Yes.
Are there any limits in the present rule that would ensure the reliability of a statement?
You mean the reliability of the declarant statement?
Correct.
No, nothing other than the discretion of the trial court under rule 402 and 403, I guess the prejudicial rule, that the evidence must have some indicia of reliability.
So in another case, multiple witnesses could be called to the stand to say, I spoke with Joe, and Joe said, Joe, committed the crime, and the defendant on the stand did not commit the crime. That would all be admissible under the rule as it currently stands, correct?
It could be admissible, but then we have the trial court as a gatekeeper. And I think the trial court would assess the reliability of that and whether it would cause confusion, whether it would be cumulative. I mean, there are the rules that would impinge here.
So I'm focused on the reliability component because the federal rule, which otherwise is very similar to ours, was amended in 2010. And they added the following, that in addition to saying a statement has to be against interest, it also must, quote, be supported by corroborating circumstances that clearly indicate its trustworthiness if offered in a criminal case that tends to expose the declarant to criminal liability, end quote. And that may be met in this case here. And the reason that the advisory committee gave was to assure that both the prosecution and the accused that the current rule would not be abused and that only reliable hearsay statements would be admitted. To your knowledge, has that amendment ever been considered, and would it be worth study to see if our rule might need some tweaking?
I can't say that I know that it has been considered, but I would express my concern about changing the rule though. And the reason is, let's be clear about these sort of cases, Sejulis, West, this case, these involve often criminals and unsavory individuals. And sometimes there's no way to corroborate independently what they're saying. They know what they say. For example, we have Mary Jones, as her son is saying what he's saying, but you could, I believe here we can corroborate with other independent evidence in the record as the trial went forward. But what happens in Sejulis? How would Sejulis have proven Maldonado's hearing that Camacho said that he was going to set the defendant up? How could he even prove that? I mean, that's something for the trial court to be the gatekeeper and for the jury to make the decision of the fact finder. Otherwise, under that rule, I don't think Sejulis's would ever have had a chance.
Tell me if I'm mistaken, the historical background to the declaration against interest rule is that it's inherently reliable when someone implicates himself in a crime or some civil wrong. people just don't do that. I mean, it is so against human nature for someone to implicate themselves that we consider it to be trustworthy in and of itself. I mean, that's the very basis of the rule, correct?
Correct, and that is the and that has served us well. I can only speak from 67 forward.
So I don't, look, once that test is met, I don't understand what discretion a trial court has. Like, a person implicates himself in a crime that would support a defendant's third party guilt. Like, what discretion does a court have to actually count out that evidence? I'm at a loss to think of circumstances where that could be excluded.
The one that comes to mind would be this court's case, State v. Brown, which is cited in the state's brief. In that particular case, there did have to be a finding. Did the informant really implicate himself? Were his penal interests? Because he was an agent of the police.
I understand that. Assuming the example that the chief gave, which is a classic example, someone said, I did the crime. I committed the crime. Would a court have authority to exclude that from evidence?
Over those facts, I would think it should come in.
I would think so.
I think it comes in because there's no reliability check under the state rule. And the question is whether the feds were onto something or whether they were off when they amended the rule. We'll ask the Attorney General as well to comment.
Okay.
Anything you'd like to add?
Just my conclusion, if there's no further questions, Wilbert Hanna respectfully asks this court to grant his petition and remand the matter back for new trial in the interest of fairness and justice. Should this court grant a new trial, there's a reasonable probability that the jury will acquit defendant once it is allowed to consider all of the evidence. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Martinez.
May it please the court. On the night of June 6, 1993, defendant Wilbert Hanna and co-defendant William LeCue lured Freddie Salazar and Luis Flores from Brooklyn to New Jersey under the guise of an amicable drug sale. However, that meeting was anything from amicable. Instead, the two defendants, the co-defendant and defendant, robbed, shot, and killed the two victims in an execution-style murder. Subsequently, co-defendant William LeCue was arrested and he gave statements to the police and testified at trial as well that Hanna was the one that got the guns. Hanna was the one that planned to rob and kill these two victims and subsequently gave him the guns to hide. Now, defendant was actually convicted of the two felony murder charges, two robbery charges, and one charge of possession of a weapon for unlawful purpose at trial. He now claims that he did not have the quote red report at the time of trial or prior to that, and that this was the link that he needed to support his third party guilt defense against Maurice Thomas. That Maurice Thomas, his drug dealing partner, was actually the second shooter and not him. And he also claims that the same report provided the nexus needed to admit Mary Jones's testimony. First, the red report was, if not in fact provided, should have been reasonably discovered before trial, because there were several pieces of evidence that were provided in discovery to defendant and defense attorney that alluded to or detailed the same exact facts that were summarized in the red report. For instance, the bloody piece of paper, he had that in discovery. The bloody piece of paper found in Mr. Salazar's pocket with defendant's pager number, which was confirmed to be his pager number by the service provider. That service provider also gave the police a second 1-800 pager number that was linked to him, to the defendant, and as well as Maurice Thomas. He also had Maurice Thomas's statement to the police where he says he's the one that called 911 that morning, and that he's, when the police asked him at the end of the interview, did we page you and you then came to us to talk to us? And he says, yes, you did page me. He also was privy to Mary Jones's testimony at the 104 hearing, where she says that her son Maurice Thomas was worried about this pager number that could be found in the victim's pocket, or could be found in the victim's car, rather. He was concerned because he was he was a drug dealer. He knew these two victims. He knew them from drug dealing with them before in the past. And he knew them through Maurice, through the defendant, through Wilbert Hanna. He also had other evidence, for instance, the corroboration of the CI, the confidential informant that gave the police information that that 1-800 number, the second 1-800 number that was provided by the service provider, said that that number was linked to both Thomas and to the defendant. And being that he was in possession of all of that information, it would have behooved his attorney or himself to ask which pager number, the police page that Thomas responded to on that morning after the murders, which pager number. If that information was so important to his, to corroborating his third party guilt defense, then why not inquire about it then? And if he would have inquired, if in fact he didn't have the red report and would have inquired, he would have obtained that information. But the logical explanation is that he did, that they did have the red report. The red report was only a summary of all of this evidence, except for Mary Jones's testimony, which was not admitted and was not summarized in any report. Second, Mary Jones's testimony, it was hearsay in 1994 and it remains hearsay today. And that's because the statements of Thomas to Jones were not exculpatory of the defendant and inculpatory of Thomas. And that is what is required by the rule. The whole premise of the rule is that this hearsay statements are allowed because of their inherent trustworthiness. They're trustworthy because someone is essentially telling on themselves, inculpating themselves, and therefore they're trustworthy and reliable and could come in under the hearsay exception. But here, none of the statements qualify under the exception to be admissible. And that's why Mary Jones's testimony was hearsay then and it's hearsay today. And State versus White, this court reiterates that same test, that the statement has to exculpate the defendant and it has to be sufficiently related to other statements that incriminate the declarant. And again, none of that exists. None of those scenarios exist in this case. And furthermore, the actual information of the pager number that was called would not have changed the outcome of the case in this case, because the defendant was convicted of two felony murder charges, the top charges. He was acquitted of the purposeful and knowing murder charges. And that is perhaps because the jury didn't believe fully Mr. LeCue's testimony, because it was somewhat inconsistent with the medical examiner's testimony. However, the medical examiner testified that it was possible someone was standing outside of the vehicle and not to the right of the victim. However, he said that it was important to know how the victim's face was turned. So if it was turned this way, that the shot could have entered on his left side, even if someone was standing or sitting next to him. So it wasn't inconsistent with LeCue's testimony, but the jury heard William LeCue's testimony that the defendant planned to make this robbery and to kill the two victims that day. They heard from Mark LeCue, the brother of William LeCue, the co-defendant, that William LeCue gave him the two guns to hide. And when he asked his brother, what is this about? He says, we just killed Rab and I, meaning the defendant and I just killed two Puerto Ricans. They heard from Hazel Forrester, defendant's girlfriend, who said that night he came to her apartment, the night of the murders, came to her apartment and said to her sister who opened the door, to Arlene Forrester, that he had just shot Fred. And when he went into Hazel's bedroom, he tells her, I just killed someone and I have to leave New Jersey. And he does. He does indeed leave New Jersey. He goes to Florida and he is apprehended in Florida 2-3 weeks later after the homicides occurred. His own statement, defendant's statement, was inconsistent and the jury heard that. The jury heard when he was cross-examined that he told the detectives in Florida that he actually was at the crime scene, he planned the meeting, that he went to Hazel Forrester's apartment, to his girlfriend's apartment on the night of the murders, right after the shootings, but then tells the jury a whole different story, that he never mentions Maurice Thomas to police when he's apprehended. But when he talks to the jury and testifies, he says that In fact, Maurice Thomas was present. That's the first time that Maurice Thomas was mentioned at all, that he's present, that he is there with the victims along with William LeCue, that he was acting as his bodyguard but had no gun on him. The defendant was acting as Maurice Thomas's bodyguard, had no gun on him, and then crosses the street to talk to a woman. And that while he's speaking to this woman, he hears gunshots and runs. This is a completely different story that he tells the police. The jury also heard from Rosa Flores, the wife of one of the victims, who said that night someone named Q called her. She said she didn't identify anyone named Q. And then someone named Rab came on the phone. And that's, again, the defendant's nickname. They also, the jury heard all of this testimony against the defendant. And that is why they found him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt of felony murder and the robbery charges.
Counsel, did the jury hear anything? You heard the back and forth we had with Mr. Burroughs. Did they hear anything about Mr. Thomas linking him to the crime? On your case, the direct case.
Yes. So not on the direct case, I don't believe that there's anything, but the defense attorney, of course, brings up Maurice Thomas in his summation and during the trial. He does bring up his association drug dealing with Maurice Thomas, and of course he brings him up as the potential second shooter. But I don't recall that the state brought him up in the case in chief. She does respond in summation to Maurice Thomas.
Yes. Counsel, you would concede that the state has the obligation of turning over police reports. The obligation is not on the defense attorney to figure out what police reports have been withheld. You have an obligation of turning over all the police reports.
Absolutely, Your Honor, you were correct. In the PCR hearing, the second PCR hearing, Mary Ellen Gaffney, the attorney, the assistant prosecutor that tried this case, she testified and said she was confronted with the Red Report. Did you remember turning this over? She said, I've never in my life, in my entire career, not turned over discovery. Also, she says she didn't recall because it had been so many days.
So let's take that. I don't know whether it was accidentally withheld or maybe it was given. But if it was given, try to explain to me why the defense attorney would not have brought before the jury the fact that Thomas's beeper number was in the victim's pocket. Like, why on earth would he do that? And number two, if you knew about it, okay, you knew about it, you said, then why is the prosecutor in summation saying there is not a scintilla of evidence linking Thomas to this crime? So explain those two things to me.
The first part, in the Red Report summarizes all of the evidence against the defendant, including that one part that Thomas responded to that page on that pager number and found in the victim's pocket. But other than that, all of the other evidence was.
Why wouldn't the defense, what any competent defense attorney, would you concede competent, would have brought that before the jury? No?
Your Honor, Maurice Thomas had an alibi. So Hazel and Arlene Forrester gave statements.
That's not the question I've asked you. So would any competent defense attorney, knowing that Thomas's telephone number was in the victim's pocket, okay, and the police called that number and Thomas answered, have not brought that before the jury, any competent defense attorney?
I'm not sure why he didn't. Any competent defense attorney would have, but I don't know why I wasn't there.
Then the next question I asked you is, why would the prosecutor, knowing that, make an argument in summation that there wasn't a scintilla of evidence linking Thomas to the killing? Why would the prosecutor do that?
Well, Your Honor, there wasn't. The only person that claims that Mr. Thomas was present at the crime scene at all was the defendant. The fact that Thomas responded to that page could have been discovered by reasonable diligence. And it wasn't other discovery. It was provided in other discovery. Thomas did have an alibi. Both Arlene and Hazel Forrester gave statements that he was with them the night of the murders. Perhaps that's why the defense attorney didn't bring it up. I'm not sure why.
But isn't that significant to Justice Albin's question regarding the fact that this pager number at the crime scene on the bloody piece of paper was found at the crime scene? That isn't that a link to Thomas and to the victims? And if the state was aware of that, why would the state make this forceful argument that there's not a scintilla of evidence connecting Thomas to the victims? I mean, that pager number suggests more than just communication at any point in time between the victims and Thomas. It suggests that there was communication very close in time to the crime. Well, I mean, would you agree?
Yes, but the pager number, the service provider gave a statement to police that pager, the pager that Maurice Thomas responded to, was acquired just a few days before the murders by the defendant. He went and purchased and bought this pager number like June 4th. The murders happened on June 6th, between the night of June 6th and June 7th in the morning. He's the one that went and got this pager and gave it to Maurice Thomas. Both of them had the exact same link to the pager, to that pager number.
But Thomas is the one that answered the call. Thomas is the one that answered the pager when the police called.
The one that answers the pager from police, that is correct. But there's a second pager number in that bloody piece of paper, or a second number rather, on that bloody piece of paper that Hazel Forrester testified to and said that this number is the landline to her apartment. And the person who would call was Fred. He would always call, and that he would always ask for Hannah. So there's connecting links directly to the defendant as well. So not just to Mr. Thomas in this case. And right. The defendant, he's the one that made the arrangement for the meeting that night.
Right. And wouldn't that piece of information, so we've discussed it several times already, that really the only information with regard to Thomas and his connection to the murders was defendant's own testimony. So his credibility was at issue here. And the prosecutor argues that there's, you know, aside from his defendant's self-serving testimony, there's no connection whatsoever between Thomas and the victims. But again, here we have this piece of paper with a pager that the police call and Thomas answers the phone. I don't see how that's not significant given defendant's testimony and his defense here.
I understand that, Your Honor.
Does having a pager number in your pocket put Thomas at the scene? The fact that the victim had the pager number in his pocket, did that somehow put Thomas at the scene and committing the murder?
And that's exactly, you know, the state's point, that nothing else puts him at the scene. The defendant puts him at the scene. No one else has testified.
But it links Thomas to those victims, correct? And again, the state's argument is, aside from defendant's self-serving testimony, nothing connects Thomas to those victims.
Right. But Thomas gave a statement to police that he knew the victims through the defendant, that he's dealt drugs with them, that he's purchased drugs from them.
Did the jury hear that from the state?
They heard it from the defendant. He testified that he and Thomas dealt drugs with the state's mother.
They didn't hear, this weaves into the declaration against interest, because Thomas told his mother that he had beat the drug dealers and they were supposed to bring drugs to him. I mean, that's a direct connection between Thomas and the two guys who wound up getting killed. And then Thomas's telephone number is in the victim's pocket. You know,
I guess that makes him the murderer then.
That doesn't necessarily. So look, the question is whether that should have been before the jury. We're not fact finders here. Mm-hmm. The jury is supposed to determine who committed this murder. And the question is whether or not critical information was withheld from the jury. I mean, that's the issue. No?
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
When we started out, the real question here is whether there was ineffective assistance of counsel. Whether somehow the Red Report or the information in the Red Report was discovered and was not previously discoverable. your first argument was that if the Red report wasn't provided, and while the prosecutor didn't specifically remember providing that report, but she always provides all the reports, you then said that the bloody piece of paper in the pocket referred to in the Red report with Thomas's pager number, and I believe also the defendant's pager number, was in fact turned over to defendant and defense counsel. Is that correct?
So the bloody piece of paper was in fact in discovery with the pager numbers that the defendant should have recognized.
Okay, my next question.
Yes.
The pager that Thomas answered was in fact defendant's pager that he gave to Thomas, correct?
That is correct. He testified that he had multiple pager numbers and he gave one of them to Thomas, and he acknowledged that he had just purchased a pager number and a pager a few days before the murders happened, and he acknowledged that that's the one. He was cross-examined on it by the state, and he acknowledged that pager number, he said it must be the one that's mine, because they wouldn't put the wrong number on this report. They wouldn't give you the wrong number.
So there's no dispute that before trial they had the copy of the bloody piece of paper referred to in the Red report, the copy of the bloody piece of paper with the pager number purchased by the defendant attributable to Thomas. There's no dispute about any of that, is there?
Right. There is no dispute about that. There's never been a dispute about them being in possession. And the prosecutor summed up to the bloody piece of paper. It was in discovery. It was in evidence. It's part of the record, and it was definitely in discovery.
So what was new?
So coming back to Justice Albin's question, defense counsel, a competent defense attorney, would have inquired about Thomas's pager being on the bloody piece of paper in the victim's pocket, except that his client's pager number was also on the bloody piece of paper found in the victim's pocket.
That is correct, Your Honor. And in fact, page one of the Red report at the bottom, the first thing that it says about the defendant is that pager number with telephone number listed to Rab, who is the defendant, was found in the victim's car. Rab is identified as Wilbur Hannah. And furthermore, the prosecutor at the second PCR hearing, when she's confronted not just with the Red report and says, I don't recall whether it was turned over, but I've never not turned anything over. They confront her and cross-examine her also with other reports, and she doesn't recall about those either. And neither do none of the PCR attorneys, the trial attorney. They don't recall any of the documents because it had been so many years that passed by.
The jury, tell me if I'm mistaken, because I just want to be clear about the record. The jury knew that the defendant's number, at least his number, was in the pocket. What they didn't know was that Thomas's number was there, because no one told the jury that. Am I correct about that?
So it's the same number, Your Honor. You're correct. It's the same number. The same number that Hannah is registered to Hannah is the same number that Thomas answered when he was paged. It's the same exact number. Hannah, the defendant, gave it to Mr. Thomas. They were drug dealers. So they shared pager numbers for the purpose of selling drugs.
But the link that was not clear before the Red report, tell me if I'm wrong, is that when the way that they got in touch with Thomas was to call that pager number and he answered. That was not before the jury. Is that correct?
My understanding is that that's not before the jury, Your Honor. That was in the Red report, but it's also, it could have been reasonably discovered. That's our argument, that it was reasonably discoverable because of all these other pieces of evidence that alluded or pointed to him being paged, pager numbers that were linked to the defendant. He could have inquired if that was so important, and he didn't in fact have the report, then why not inquire what pager number was it that the police paged and that he answered?
Counsel, I want to go back a step and ask you to clarify something. We need to accept that the Red report was not turned over. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. Okay. If there were some sort of finding along the way that it had been turned over, then there's no claim for newly discovered evidence because it's not new. So the posture that we are at the moment is that it wasn't turned over for whatever reason. Is that fair?
Sure.
And so then the test for us is, would it change the outcome? That's the key question under the third prong.
So under the third prong, Your Honor, it wouldn't change the outcome of—
And before we get to that ultimate question though, I'm struggling with the argument that defendant should have found this on his own. Typically in a case of newly discovered evidence, or I should say often, you know, a defendant will identify a witness after the verdict who presents additional information previously unknown and comes forward and says, here, judge, I should get a new trial. And the question is, well, shouldn't you, through reasonable diligence, have known that beforehand? Here, the premise is that the state had relevant discoverable material that was not disclosed to the defense. Does that factor in some way to our analysis of the second prong under Ways?
Well, Your Honor, under Ways, the exact language escapes me, but it's an issue of finality. It's an issue of, that it behooves the defense attorney and defendant to ensure that they have certain information if it's exculpatory evidence. If there's other evidence pointing to it, then why not inquire? It's part of the test. It has to be analyzed under that prong. So
if there was a discovery violation, which appears to have been the case based on where we stand now, that's not an appropriate consideration?
If there was a discovery violation, whether that should be considered?
Is that relevant to our analysis of the Ways formula, the Ways standard?
Well, under prong three, I don't think it would matter whether it was turned over or not, because if it wasn't—
I think the real question is prong two, and I don't have the answer, that's why I'm asking you. There's something off at first blush to hear, well, the defendant should have figured this out on his own if indeed the state committed a discovery violation and didn't turn over that which it should have. Do you follow me?
I do.
Those don't seem to fit nicely together.
I do follow what Your Honor is saying. That, you know, of course the state has an obligation to turn over all discovery, especially exculpatory information. There's no question about that. But under the test and exactly the language that is under in Ways and in Carter, that the language suggests that there's an issue of finality as well, that it should be balanced. That of course a defendant that is wrongfully convicted should have a pathway and a framework to defend himself, to bring up, to appeal, to have a direct appeal, to have a PCR. That there's an issue also that you have to balance that with finality, and that if a jury heard all of this evidence, I think that's why prong three is also there.
So go to prong three and respond please to this question.
Yes.
You have what Justice Patterson pointed to earlier as evidence that Thomas picked up the phone when the number on the piece of paper was dialed.
Okay.
Add to that what Jones says Thomas said, we were gonna set up the defendant and the defendant was to take the weight. How does that bear on the outcome of the trial?
Sure, so that statement that he was gonna set up the defendant to take the weight was made in the same breath that he's telling his mother that he's at the homicide headquarters and that he's helping police, he's cooperating with them to ensure that they capture him. And he also volunteers to be, to have his phone tapped and tells his mother, your phone's going to be tapped. So if he calls, if Mr. Hanna calls, keep him on the line. So that's
the
context.
Would you agree that the ordinary meaning of setting someone up and having someone take the weight is not helpful to the state's case in this context?
I understand the ordinary meaning is just to frame someone, if you may, but there was also testimony from Ms. Jones that she says her son was involved in taking some drugs from Hannah previously and that Hannah didn't know, that the defendant didn't know he had taken some drugs from him and basically was afraid that he would find out. So that's also part of the context here, that he wasn't setting him up to take the weight, but that he was cooperating with police. He had nothing to do with this homicide, but he wanted to make sure that Hannah didn't find out that he took the drugs from him. So that's part of the context here. As per prong three, the state had to prove the weight of the state's evidence against the defendant was strong with regard to the felony murders. Prong three, in ways, the court says that the evidence and new evidence has to have a rational tendency to engender a reasonable doubt with respect to an essential feature of the state's case. And I don't believe that piece of information that Thomas answered a page would have engendered a reasonable doubt as to the felony murders and the robbery, because there was so much evidence against him. Hazel Forrester, Mark LaCue, William LaCue all gave testimony that defendant admitted to killing Freddie Salazar.
But Ms. Martinez, I have to keep coming back. Is it just whether or not he heard about that pager number, or is it that plus the effect it had on the jury of not being able to hear Ms. Jones's statement? I don't see how we can separate those two, because that was the cumulative effect of this issue, if you will, and how it played out at the trial of defendant.
Yes, Your Honor. There, in State versus White, there's a part of the case where they address extrinsic evidence when analyzing declarations against interest, that I believe it's page 240, where the court says that that it's not necessary to look at extrinsic evidence, that the statement itself has to pass the test, whether it exculpates the defendant and inculpates the declarant at the same time.
I don't think White says
that. I don't think there's any dispute that there's a hearsay problem, not a hearsay problem here.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not certain that you have the declaration against interest rule correct. Because when you look, and I'm gonna refer to White in a second, what happened in White. The declaration against interest rule, when you read it, just says that a person has to say something that would be so contrary to his criminal or civil interest. What White was, the problem in White was that the defendant was attempting to get out hearsay that was exculpatory. And he can't do that unless it also happens to be against his interest. And that's what the court was balancing. The court was saying, you can't get that exculpatory evidence in unless you somehow link it to the declaration against interest. It wasn't saying that in all circumstances, a declaration against interest has to exculpate. A declaration against interest just has to be a declaration against interest and be relevant. That's all. Am I mistaken about that?
No, you're not. That is the test. But here, our argument is still that there's nothing against Thomas's interest that is put forth by Mary Jones, that he tells his mother anything that is against his own interest, except for the fact that he sells drugs, which is already a known fact. Therefore, I don't think that any of those statements are admissible under the rule.
Other questions, anyone? Anything you'd like to add, Ms. Martinez?
I would just ask that the court affirm the appellate division's decision, albeit under a different analysis, since the appellate division did find that prong three was not met by the defendant, but they found it under a different analysis.
Thank you.
Mr.
Finkelstein.
Thank you. Briefly address three concerns that were raised from some of the questions. And I want to suggest that these are really the outside of the case. They're not the central issues in the case. The central issues are the newly discovered evidence claim and whether defendant could bootstrap an evidentiary argument with his newly discovered evidence claim. So I want to briefly address the issue about Brady and the Chief Justice's question about it. And I think from a certain perspective, it doesn't make sense to couple a newly discovered evidence claim with a Brady claim when the newly discovered evidence is part of a report that should have been disclosed. So in Carter, the court discussed both of them together, one after the other. But in this case, we have a finding by the PCR court affirmed by the appellate division that there was no Brady violation because defendant failed to prove that the evidence was suppressed. So then to turn around and to have a newly discovered evidence claim doesn't follow, and it doesn't make sense to follow with a newly discovered evidence claim based on something that has been held to have been not suppressed. So that's certainly a problem. Anytime you bring a newly discovered evidence claim based on something in discovery, the Brady question should be the sole focus of the entire case from a certain standpoint. And the second issue that goes to that is some federal courts, when addressing Brady, have a reasonable diligence prong to the discovery in any event. So even assuming it wasn't provided, and even assuming that it was not provided, some federal courts incorporate what is essentially the second prong of Carter into the Brady analysis. So that would really address both concerns, and I hope.
So we have much more expansive discovery than the federal system. So the federal system uses Brady. We have open discovery. Do you concede that the Red Report had to be turned over? It falls within the discovery rules that the prosecutor had a mandatory obligation of turning over the Red Report.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. And do you concede that the Red Report was relevant to the defense of the defendant? The fact that in the Red Report, Thomas's number was on a bloody piece of paper, and then the prosecutor's detective called up Thomas and he answered. Would you concede that that was relevant?
Yes.
Okay.
So the problem, of course, is that there was no Brady violation. And so I hope that addressed the Chief Justice's question. And I want to address the summation. I think it's never a good idea to discuss a prosecutor's summation.
You don't think that was exculpatory? I know you're using the term Brady now. You don't think that was relevant and helpful to the defense?
Oh, well, let me try to clarify my point. I agree that yes, I agree. My point is simply that the PCR court found no Brady violation because the PCR court found that the evidence was not suppressed. Defendant doesn't have a Brady claim. So to turn around and base a newly discovered evidence claim on something that should have been disclosed, it can't follow. They're two inconsistent theories to base a newly discovered evidence claim on something that should have been discovered when you already have a decision that the Brady claim lacks merit. My point is anytime you have a newly discovered evidence claim based on discovery, it should only be treated under the Brady doctrine.
Merely because the lower court judge said that this isn't exculpatory doesn't mean that that's so. I mean, that's why we're before this court. Look, the appellate division in this case completely misconstrued the declaration against interest rule. You concede that?
That's for the last sentence?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. I mean, so they make mistakes below. That's why we're before the Supreme Court.
Yes, we're not here on the Brady issue. So I was just trying to address the chief's question.
Can I clarify something on Brady?
Of course.
I thought the trial court and appellate division didn't say Red was not exculpatory, didn't say Red did not have to be disclosed. What they said was the defendant didn't demonstrate that it was not disclosed.
Exactly.
They didn't meet their burden of showing that they didn't get this report.
Exactly.
And so your argument is you can't now say I didn't have the Red information when the court's already determined that you didn't prove that you didn't have the Red information. That's what your point was.
That's exactly right. The PCR court should never have addressed the newly discovered evidence claim once it rejected the Brady claim based on that idea. But that was really just to address the chief's concern on that issue. And the summation has to be taken, of course, in consideration following defense counsel's summation.
Before you get to the summation, if you could, remind me, didn't the active send it back and say, take a look at the newly discovered evidence issue after dispensing with Brady?
Yes.
So strikes me that the earlier exchange may not be the end of the discussion.
Well, I can't explain that, Your Honor. I mean, I to send it back for reconsideration of whether that was newly discovered evidence, I think Justice Solomon phrased it perfectly, is that it really, if you do have an, if you don't have a Brady claim because it wasn't suppressed, and if your newly discovered evidence claim is based on discovery, I mean, it doesn't follow. I think your example, to Mr. Chief Justice, it's usually the case that newly discovered evidence claim is based on something you hear after the trial from an investigator, from a witness you didn't know existed, from a source that isn't discovery. And my point here was to address Your Honor's question about whether Brady should be considered in the second prong. My answer is twofold, that first, the federal courts incorporate the second, some federal courts incorporate the second prong of Carter into the Brady analysis. And also, I think the concern that Your Honor was having was based on the idea that there was a discovery violation. I hope I'm not assuming incorrectly, that was part of the trouble. And the PCR court rejected the Brady claim, and then the appellate division affirmed. And as to Your Honor's point, I don't understand why it was remanded for further consideration of the newly discovered evidence claim.
So you have answered my question, and it dovetails a little with what Justice Solomon was asking you about. Your point is, there is a tension in the way that second prong would be analyzed, but it's resolved by saying, listen, it's either a failure to disclose, or it's something that was discovered truly for the first time after the fact, but it can't be both.
In essence, I believe that's right. Either it was disclosed, and then you can't have a newly discovered evidence claim. If it wasn't disclosed, then you have the start of a Brady claim, and then in theory, you could have a newly discovered evidence claim, assuming you've met the second prong of the test.
So you know, we actually addressed this in ways. So even if you were going to accept that a reasonably diligent attorney should have found the piece of evidence that would have exculpated the defendant, and therefore you're not going to be able to proceed on a newly discovered evidence, we specifically said in ways, well, in that type of circumstance, we would probably find the attorney ineffective, because we wouldn't let, and this is the language basically, we wouldn't let a defendant languish in prison because the exculpatory evidence was withheld from a totally ineffective attorney. If the fact is that this evidence that seems to be critical in this case didn't get before the jury, either because it was withheld by the state or because the attorney was totally incompetent. In any event, did the defendant get a fair trial? Isn't that the ultimate issue?
A few responses, Your Honor. First, the quote from Ways is actually linked to probable innocence. So the court was saying that the court wouldn't let someone sit in jail who's probably innocent based on ineffective assistance of counsel. Of course, the Attorney General agrees with that idea. We don't have a probable innocence case here. We probably don't even have a colorful claim of innocence here. But putting that aside, we also don't, a defendant could have brought an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. That's not what we're adjudicating now. That's not what the court is going to adjudicate now. And the third response is, Your Honor suggested that there's two alternatives. Either it was not disclosed, or if it was disclosed, counsel was ineffective. But a defendant also has obligations. And this is why we have competency, the doctrine of competency. And there's a flip side to it, that the defendant is obligated to assist his counsel. Counsel is an agent, and the principal is the defendant. And here, defendant had this information. He was the best source.
But if assuming you withheld, and this is the way it's coming up to us, the state withheld the evidence, and now you're going to blame the defendant because somehow he didn't assist, and then permit the prosecutor to misinform the jury about what was in the pocket of the victim, is that what you're saying is permissible?
Absolutely not. No one's assuming that it, well, I mean, that's kind of the problem. I'm certainly not assuming that it was suppressed when you have a PCR court and an appellate division decision saying the opposite. So that's certainly not our assumption. But even if that is the assumption, then using the newly discovered evidence test, you still have the second prong. And what I want to suggest about the defendant is that he knew Moti was using this number. So he's the one with the information who should be giving that information to his attorney. His attorney can't figure things out if he's not saying Moti had this.
So this is what I'm having a problem with. You're saying, oh, the defendant should have helped his attorney because the state withheld exculpatory information from the defense attorney. Is that the argument you're making?
No, our argument is that it was never withheld. Because there is a Brady argument in this case. It was rejected. The court found no Brady violation because it was not suppressed. But then yes, if you assume it was suppressed under the newly discovered evidence test, you have the second prong. Certainly the court fashioned the second prong, and the second prong asked what could the defendant have done. If the defendant has the information already.
How would the defendant have known that Red called up Thomas? How would he know unless he had read the Red report? Like, how would he know that? He didn't know. The defendant couldn't have known what Red had done with that number, made the call. Am I mistaken?
Yes, it's in the statement that defendant had, Moti's statement with the police. They acknowledged that they paged Moti. So the question is, where did they get his number? So it's within hours of the crime that they're paging him. So the most logical inference to make, of course, is they got the number from the crime scene. But putting that aside, the reason the police are calling the number is because they don't know who's going to respond. Defendant already knows the answer to that. Defendant knows who's using the beeper. So from an important perspective, defendant has this information, doesn't even need to take the step that the police had to take to acquire this information. Defendant essentially already had it.
He also, just so I can clarify something, and I think Ms. Martinez already acknowledged it, he also had the bloody piece of paper in the pocket of the victim that is referred to in the Red report with the numbers on it, his pager number and Thomas or Moti's pager number. He's got both of them. And okay. That's true, right? Ms. Martinez said yes. Is that
absolutely
true?
Absolutely. It's mentioned at trial. There's no objection. There's no surprise to this. It's clear that they knew about it because it's discussed at trial. It's actually marked for identification at the beginning of trial. It's there. They certainly knew about it. And they can't really claim they didn't know about it, because the more things they claim they don't know about, then it destroys the credibility that he never saw the report. If you start saying, I never saw this, 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 and this, but.
I'm just trying to clarify that one point, because there've been some things said that confused me a little bit.
But wasn't the argument at trial that the numbers were subscribed to by the defendant, correct?
Yes.
So certainly no one's disputing that they had the numbers and it was on that piece of paper, but the state did not further state, oh, and by the way, one of those numbers was called by the police and Thomas answered that phone.
Of course not, because the state's not
because they didn't have
evidence helpful to the defendant.
Right.
Of course not. And just to address the summation, it was made following defense counsel's summation, where defense counsel puts in all this information about Moti that really wasn't supported by the evidence. So the prosecutor's really trying to respond to that. And so it really was fair comment, which is exactly what the appellate division held on direct appeal. And before I move away from the second prong of the Carter test, it's important to understand that Moti could have been called. So if defendant wants to establish that Moti would have answered this phone, that it was his phone number, Moti could have been called and could have been asked about this at the time of trial. So there's this idea that defendant has set forth that it's what was missing was this direct link. And if he had the direct link, the whole trial would have been different because the testimony would have been admitted. But that's wrong for a few reasons. The trial judge never mentions the idea that there needs to be a direct link. The trial judge's concerns are different. Trial judge's concern is about hearsay and confusion and misleading the jury. In any event, defendant could have just put on this direct link by calling Moti, and we obviously don't know what Moti would have said.
And Mr. Finkelstein, we know exactly what Mr. Thomas would have said because he was the one, as the public defender's arguing, has been pushing this, the state and the police in the direction of defendant right from the beginning. So the state had already successfully blocked the testimony of Motee's mother, who would have undercut any contrary story that Mr. Thomas would have said on the stand. So when you say, why didn't they call them? It's perfectly understandable why they're not going to call somebody who's been only pointing the finger at Hannah, when the person who could have undercut his credibility has already been blocked.
I disagree, Your Honor. He could have been called for the limited purpose of establishing that that was his number, which he would have likely admitted because he knows that the police paged him from that number. So he's certainly going to get caught in a lie, and you don't have to ask witnesses all kinds of questions. That's
exactly what defendant said he didn't know, that they didn't know that Mr. Thomas had been called based on that number.
Of course, but he knows he had been called, and he knows that the number found on the piece of paper in the pocket goes to Motee. It's such a natural inference that the second...
Really? Is that the only pager Mr. Thomas had? Do we know that from this record?
Of course not. But then you have to at least ask, where are they paging him from? The fact that that's why we have the second prong of the Carter test. So we don't have a new trial 25 years later, when all of this could have been remedied by a question in the mid-90s.
Look, to me, it's extraordinary to expect that the defense attorney will call to the stand the person who is using every ounce of his energy to set him up, as his own mother said, and to put the weight on him. And you're flipping that burden on the defendant when the state has withheld information from defense counsel. That just seems to me extraordinary.
Witnesses can be called for limited purposes. The trial judge mentions this for important reason. He says Motee is available. I mean, certainly the trial judge wasn't mentioning it for no reason. This fact could have been established at trial. If defendant is basing his entire claim on this fact, it could have been established at the time of trial based on what defendant knew at the time.
It's interesting that the state didn't call Mr. Thomas if he was such a linchpin witness, because if he was, then perhaps his credibility could have been attacked through the testimony of his mother.
Sure, I mean, I don't know why they didn't call him. Certainly that's something they may have considered and may have thought about at the time.
Strategically didn't call Detective Red either.
Right.
Very interesting.